Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Birju Pandya, and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you so much for joining us. The purpose of these calls is about sharing stories, listening to stories, and being part of stories that are about planting seeds for a more compassionate society. And the purpose of doing that is engaging in our own inner transformative process. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life, people who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold the space. Today, our special guests are Marina Durbin and Mark Barone, who are doing amazing work in supporting the movement of animal rights justice and arts and aesthetics. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let us start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves. Thank you. And welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today, in conversation with Mark Barone and Marina Durbin. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Ari Nessel, will engage in a dialogue with both of our speakers. And by the top of the hour, we will shift over into a Q&A, where you can play a role in sharing your reflections or your insights from the call. Just so that you're aware, even now, you're welcome to get in the queue for that Q&A process at any point in the hour, even prior to the Q&A beginning. You can do so by pressing *6 on your touchtone phone, or you can ask a question online by emailing ask@servicespace.org. That is ask@servicespace.org. We invite all your reflections and your questions. And I've opened up the queue right now, so please go ahead and engage with that however it feels appropriate to you. As we mentioned, this week's theme is focused on compassion, specifically diving into compassion towards all kinds of living beings, such that humanity and beyond is free from discrimination and feels supported across the board. Since we have a remarkable moderator, Ari Nessel, here today, I thought we could ask him to reflect on the theme as we get started. And to give you a little bit of context, Ari is no stranger to this question of living in compassion himself. He's been practicing this approach for some time. In many, many different forms, but a couple that seems salient for this conversation is that he has been a supporter of the animal rights movement for decades at this point, as well as being involved in social justice work as a co-founder of the wonderful nonprofit foundation, the Pollination Project, which supports people who are taking steps towards a compassionate existence. Ari, thank you for joining us and moderating this call.
Oh, it's an honor, Birju, and you have been a great supporter and benefactor in growing my consciousness of compassion. So thank you so much. I'm thinking as we start off this phone call, the story that's been so influential for me of this teacher who has these two students. He's a spiritual teacher, and he gives them each a chicken. And he says, go somewhere where no one can see and kill the chicken and bring it and come back to me when you're done. And very quickly, one of the students comes back with a dead chicken in his arms. The other one doesn't return for over 24 hours. And when he finds his teacher, the teacher says he sees him with the chicken in his hands, but alive and well. And the teacher asks, what happened? And the student says, everywhere I go, the chicken sees. And I think that as I engage in this conversation here, Mark and Marina, it's this honor of being with people who have this capacity to see that the chicken sees, the dog sees, the cat sees, the cow sees, that we as humans are not alone in this capacity for both for joy and for sorrow, for pain, and for presence to the miracle of living on this blue planet. So a little bit about our guests, Mark and Marina. There are a couple dedicated to raping consciousness around animal welfare, and we believe that everyone can learn to cultivate deep roots of compassion at any age and to help to create a world that is rich in humanity and free from discrimination. And so, you know, one of their guiding questions is what tools and practices in our lives and their lives and your life allow us to deepen the roots of compassion across different boundaries. So with that, I welcome you both, Mark and Marina, for dialogue.
Hi there. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I just want to start off just, you know, with some very basics. Tell me can you tell me a little bit about your work in the world? What is it that you are both working on?
I painted 5,500 portraits of shelter dogs, which is the number that are killed every day in this country. And the object was to actually use art for social change and creativity for social change. And I think the visuals are so important because, you know, people throw around numbers and they talk about it and it's so easy to dismiss. And I thought it was extremely important to actually put a face with the number being killed on a daily basis. And really that's just dogs. But the dogs are symbolic of all shelter animals, not just dogs. And so that's the path that we started going down almost 6 years ago now. And so I completed the 5,500 about a year ago, year and a half ago, and now our project is taking, you know, on really the second level of what it's intended to do.
And when you started this 6 years ago, can you share with everyone with a little bit of impetus for how this came about? This you know, this was a big commitment. This is 50, you know, you didn't make a commitment to paint five pieces, artistic pieces of dogs. But 5,500, and so when you made this commitment, it wasn't. I imagine you felt like this was like a long term commitment. So what was the impetus that got you started, and then how did you sustain that over this long haul?
This is Marina. I'll tell you a little bit about the catalyst for it. Was you know, Mark and I had been in a fairly new relationship. It had been about a year or so. And his dog, Santina, she was about 22 when she died. And I had always been a cat lady before that. And I, you know, obviously I love all animals, but that's kind of what I grew up with. And getting to know Santina just was a whole different relationship. So shortly after she died, probably about 6 months later, I thought, well, it would be a nice thing to do would be to adopt another dog. So I'm sure of it. It could have been another day. It may have been a different experience for me. But on that day, I was looking online at dogs that were available for adoption. And instead of finding a dog, somehow I came across these pages that were about giving me statistics of what was going on in the shelters. They were talking about the gas chambers. It was just, you know, a whole different thing I wasn't actually fully aware of. Of course, I was aware about all the other animal issues as a vegan, but I really didn't know what was going on at the shelter level. So it really affected me deeply. And, you know, I was sad, I was outraged, I was all kinds of things. And so I kept sending Mark those images, those graphic videos, very hard to look at visuals. And as an artist, the only way he could respond, well, of course, initially it was like, you know, quit sending me that stuff. It's I got it. You know, I don't need to see any more. So I kept sending it. And so, and this all happened in a very short window. And so within about a day or so, it obviously penetrated Mark also in a deep way, such that he woke up and said to me, okay, see if you can get me an approximate number of dogs so I can illustrate at least one animal, and I can do it. You know, it's actually feasible that I could paint that number. So that's really how the whole thing began. And so that the journey then became, so then we named it An Active Dog, and that was really the catalyst for the whole thing.
Mm. So you're looking at these videos and you're finding them really difficult to look at, yet you're still watching them and you're still sending them down to Mark. Like, yeah. tell me a little bit about that. Like, how does, like, most people, in my experience, they watch the first 3 seconds and they turn it off because it's unpleasant to see. What is it that allows you to keep watching and then and paying attention to the difficult to watch videos and the graphic images?
Well, as an individual, I'm very interested in reality, and I'd much rather face, you know, reality as it is and deal with the emotions that come up with that. And as I had, I think about 32 years ago, I changed my diet to a vegan plant-based diet, and my entryway in was through health. But of course, what happened after going into that world, you become exposed to all the compassionate side of animals. And so I obviously became very aware and had seen all of the graphic imagery and videos that were associated with cows and pigs and everything else. And so I was really comfortable looking at it, because, you know, without facing it, you can't feel it, and without feeling it, you're not actually going to do anything to fix it. So I just wasn't aware. You know, I really believe that, you know, the sheltering to me, you know, people have cats and dogs, and that's really a matter of having nurturing and compassion and responsibility and taking care of your companion animal. I understand that educating people about the other side, the other animals, involves a whole other education and dealing with people's ideology. So it's just a different thing to educate on. So I think I was shocked to see people at the level of companion animals, where it's not something you eat. It's something that it's a being that we've had a relationship with for a long time. It was shocking to see, wow, even at that level, we don't have humanity. And so I couldn't stop looking at it. And so I felt compelled, even though it was very uncomfortable for Mark to look at it. And, you know, when people say, no, quit sending me that, I don't want to see it, that doesn't stop me. I'll still send it, you know, with somebody that I'm close to. And even if it brings up friction and tension, I'm happy to do that, because it's not about us, you know. So that's really how it began. It wasn't easy, but it was necessary.
And Mark, can you tell me, like, as you're receiving these videos from Marina, like, what's going on with you? And, like, how does that, whatever was going on with you, translate into coming up with this idea?
Well, you know, for me, when I was looking at the imagery, because I'm, you know, just being an artist for so long, I'm very visual, so it was very difficult to look at, and just the callousness that this was carried out, and it was just so dismissive of souls and the way they disposed of these animals. It was like. Putting some plastic bottles in the recycle bin for them. And it was just the lack of compassion that had left these people when they were doing this, because it just became a job. And and I know what the animals in my life meant to me. And so it was very hard for me to relate to that. And so things like that never prompt me into, you know, just being kind of laying there in a fetal position. What can I do? I mean, I always think about, you know, how can I take this imagery and do something with it, and how can I make it powerful enough that it's going to actually engage people and change their minds, or engage people into this conversation about what's going on? Because when you think of the word shelter, you think of, well, a safe place for these animals to be. And in many cases, it's not. There are some shelters that do very good work, but there's still a great majority of them that don't. So the imagery was very rough to look at. I mean, very rough to look at. The way we just discarded this these animals is just, it was unbelievable to me. And for me, I kind of, the kind of imagery that was starting to fly through my head at the time was the Vietnam War Memorial. I thought of imagery from the Holocaust and the Holocaust Museum, and all these things. And I saw some parallels there that really prompted me, because I've been to both of them many, many times, and to me they're very moving. And as an artist, you know, I want to be able to do something that has beauty, but also, it's a dichotomy where there's beauty and there's just horror at the same time. But there's beauty in the painting and beauty in the soul that you've tried to capture, but there's also horror in what's actually happened to these animals. And so, I mean, all of those things go through my head. And so, I really had to get into the images that I was painting on a very deep level in order to do them. Otherwise, I mean, I probably would have done 20 or 30 of them, and that would have been the end of it. So, I mean, it touched me in a very deep way, and made me want to try to do something or use the talents that I had to actually try to make a difference.
And as you think about, Mark, like the first one you painted versus the 100th versus the 1,000th versus the 5,000th painting, like what is, like, energetically, is it like, Does it go from exciting to tedious? Does it what is it like? Or is it just change from one to one depending on what's going on the rest of your day? How do you, like, relate to this, like, really big long term commitment that you made, that you're sticking with as you go along the path of, you know, over five, you know, almost 5 years of painting?
Well, you know, at first, you know, I mean, the ignorance of doing something like this is really a wonderful thing, because, you know, you have all this energy and everything else when you started. And it's not that I didn't have energy at the end, because I had a different kind of energy at the end. But, you know, you just don't know what this path is. You think you do when you start it, but you really don't know. And so there was this, I think at about, The first 100, I understood how long it took me to paint those. And then my mind, the way it starts working is I start projecting, you know, I've got to do 5,400 more of these. And so it starts to play with your mind a little bit. Can I actually do this? Can I actually get it done? And then the other thing is that I think after a while, this low-level depression kind of set in with me. And I don't think it's left. To be honest with you. And I think that it was needed. I don't think that, you know, you can go through this skipping and whistling and singing because that's not what the subject matter is. And so there's this kind of low-level buzz of depression that I think hung over me for the last 4 years of painting. And it's because that, you know, I tried to connect, you know, because I could see it in their eyes. You know, I could see it in the eyes of these animals that Marina would get for me, and they came from rescue groups that couldn't get them out in time, or rescue groups that got there like 10 minutes late and they killed the animal anyway. And so there was this, you could see it in their eyes. I mean, when they took the pictures of these dogs, when they were trying to get them adopted, you could see the fear in their eyes. You could see their souls. You could see all this stuff when you looked at them, their postures, everything. And it told the story. And so there's a few things that happened. One is that as it went on, my resolve became stronger as I went on to make this happen and to show this number. And the other thing that happened is that artistically is that I was able to capture things in a couple strokes that took me 20 strokes to do when I first started painting them, and it took me 2 strokes to do by the 5,000. And so there was all these transformations that happened throughout. And so, you know, to take a stroke of paint and to have it be meaningful and to say that, you know, by just putting this paint on there and pushing it in a certain way and pulling it in a certain way, it captures emotion. And so I realized how to do that. And after 5,000 paintings, you start to really kind of, find that that emotion that you're looking for in a much easier way than I did when I first started.
It almost sounds like Zen calligraphy, where like the Zen masters can very quickly create an artistic piece with very few strokes. Did it feel like as you're doing that, was that a need for efficiency, or is it also just sort of like an intuitive wisdom, would you say, that was sort of coming through as well?
Yeah, I think it was some of both, and I think that the further I got into the project, the deeper I got into each animal, and the connection I felt more and more towards each of them as individual souls. And I think it was, it just came out, Marina would ask me, how do you do this? And, I don't think about that stuff anymore. Just like the Zen master, when he's doing calligraphy, it's just within him, and he does it, and he does the stroke, and it is what it is, and it says what he wants it to say. And so in the same way, when I'm putting down a stroke that's either the face or whatever it is, it's doing what I want it to do. I mean, it's the color I want it to be. It's the value I want it to be. It's the size I want it to be. It's, the pressure that I want it to be. And so I don't really think about it anymore. It just becomes part of me as I'm doing it and as I'm trying to relate to the imagery.
Yeah, I'm just picturing what it's like making this long-term commitment and this low-level depression, which feels like to me just this deepening of empathy as you do it. I have a lot of friends who do investigations of various forms of animal abuse, and they're watching, and they'll be editing the video, and they're looking at all the time, trying to make the videos as powerful as possible, so that people seeing it will really capture, the cruelty that exists, and I think about a lot about how they're affected by doing that. And Marina, I'm just curious, as you're watching, Mark go through this low level depression, which seems like a very natural response to what he's working on. How are you helping sustain him? Are you saying, Mark, you got to take a pause here? What's going on with your relationship as you're seeing this, and how are you supporting one another?
Well, fortunately, that's my background. So, helping people navigate emotions and inner conflict and suffering. So that was a real plus, because given that the relationship was so new and we took this on at such an early stage, it's something you have to know how to navigate. You have to know how to hear someone and make it okay for them to be wherever they're at, and to help them express that in a more complete way, so that there's an emptying out, so they can make room for more of that. Because it's one thing if you're going to face something for a day and then you're not going to face it again. But if you're facing it, 8 to 10 hours a day, there has to be an emptying for you to be able to take in the other souls, because he really did connect with each one of them. And I would say, as the person that also took the photographs of the paintings themselves, it was something that I noticed that happened from the beginning, and what changed as we got to about the, I would say, just before the halfway point, was the initial paintings, the composition, showed more of the whole body of the animal, the environment of the animal, the cage, the bowl, or, things like that. And in a way, it was a little bit easier, not that it's easy to stomach at all, but there's something about the distance that was a little bit softer to take in. So what happened to Mark as an artist, and I think of the hand as an extension of the heart, of a true artist that's really doing work for social change. And what happened was, as he got further into it, and there was a deepening in Mark's opening, such that the paintings then, he zoomed in into the face, into the eyes. So you no longer saw the environment or the whole body of the animal. The face was right in your face. The eyes were right looking at you. So there wasn't anywhere to turn. There was nowhere else to focus on that painting but the soul, right into the eyes. So that was a really significant thing that I noticed. And I believe that it happened as Mark's own process changed, his own as a being himself, because, you know, he started to, his diet changed. His compassion became much deeper and much richer. So there was it was multi-leveled of transformation going on.
Yeah, so Mark, can you speak to a little bit about how this process, you know, how you've been transformed by in the process of trying to transform, you know, societal consciousness?
Yeah, I think for me, going through this process of doing this project and the issues that we were dealing with, you know, your compassion, my compassion for the animals, and really trying to put myself in their place has really changed how I look at things, and to not really look away at things that are happening. And so I'm much more open to looking at problems in a very deep way. And I did to a certain extent with the human condition before I even did this project, but this project just took everything to a level that I have really never experienced before. And painting and being an artist is a solitary, isolated profession anyway, so you are really there with your own mind and your own thoughts. And it was really difficult days, but I learned to be comfortable with that, whereas before I would just I would shut it off and turn it off because it was hard. It was hard mentally to bring that in, those kind of atrocities in. And so it allowed me to be at least open enough to start taking that stuff in and looking at it for what it was, and then figuring out what can I do about it. You know, what are the things that I can actually do to try to change this dynamic? And so it just went in very deeply, and I don't know if that had anything to do with me or just the level of commitment that I had, that it actually had to go in, because I know for me as an artist, I just cannot paint things for the sake of painting, you know, to push paint for the sake of pushing paint. I've never been able to do. So there always had to be a purpose to what I was doing. And so the purpose here for what we were doing and what we were trying to accomplish, it was very rough subject matter wise. And so you had to let it in order to feel at a very deep level and to actually paint it.
So for both of you, what was your approach to self-care as you do this? Like, you're Mark, you're giving up your earning potential because you're doing all this. I'm making an assumption here. Is this pro bono you're doing, that you're painting the pieces, the art?
Yeah, I mean, I had cashed in all my retirement savings to do the project. So I mean, that's completely gone, because to do 5,500 paintings is financially a very expensive project to take on, and I haven't been on any sort of salary or any sort of pay for since we started the project, you know. And so it was something that I just had to do. I mean, it was a calling for both, I think, Marina and I. I mean, you know, I don't know how I came up with doing 5,500 paintings. I think that was because that I knew that if I didn't do anything large enough, it wouldn't garnish the attention that was needed to actually incite the change that I wanted to do and wanted to happen. And so, you know, really that was it for me.
Wow. That's a very serious commitment. So I imagine this is something you guys didn't take, you know, lightly. This is something you must have had to discuss, like cash in your savings. Like, there must have been many points along the way like where you just sort of had to take a step back and say, hey, you know, do we want to keep on doing this? Or, hey, we're actually the number of animals being dogs being killed is actually less today. Can we just lower our goal? You know, I'm wondering what were those conversations like, and what was we talked a little about the energy that I find in paying attention in my own life. There's like three kinds of energy I see. There's like this initiating energy, which also sometimes can come from anger, sometimes can come from dissatisfaction. I think that maybe started here, you know, sadness and grief. But there's like this sustaining energy that is more like, has a, you know, grounded in a little more of like, I think like a self-care and purpose, like you were talking about. And there's like this mystical energy that comes in, and I don't even, and I heard some of you talk a little about that, sort of like that you weren't painting, you're like the paintbrush was moving through your hands. So it was almost like the eyes of the dog moved through your hands. As, you know, you were an instrument. Can you tell me a little about, like, do you notice any of those forms of energy and how it maybe, how it changed a little more? And was there any of a mystical experience in the process of this painting?
I would say, of course, you know, there are the natural struggles and resistance that comes up when you see all of a sudden, and the way I would encapsulate it, it's more what it mirrored back to us was how we live these more compartmentalized lives and lives that are focused on our own individual selfish needs. And I don't think that happiness comes from that. I think happiness doesn't come from serving yourself. It comes from serving others. And we really connected to that early on, no matter what was going on with us in terms of the financial struggle, witnessing the absolute apathy from people and the excuses. I mean, those kind of things could take you down very, very quickly. And what I like to explain to people is there's a huge difference between empathy and compassion. You know, compassion is not dependent upon how you feel. It's not an emotion. It's a commitment to being in action to alleviate that suffering. So it's not like, oh, you know, I'll do something about it when I feel better. You know, oh, my God, that hurts so much. Like, you know, it's not dependent upon that. So early on, we knew that that was our commitment. You just, no matter how you felt, no matter how bad, when you could feel the energy wavering, you know, and it would come more from listening to some of the ignorance that we would hear out there, or we'd meet billionaires that could help us in a second, but that would leave us, the two of us, still struggling and doing it by ourselves. And things like that, you would just be more disappointed with that level of disconnect and the inhumanity. But ourselves, you have to change your lifestyle. So very, you know, early on, we knew, you know, it's not about us anymore. So you live on less. You know, you live a more frugal lifestyle. You don't have any luxuries. You don't, you can't go and shop. You can't go and do all the things that you do without thinking of beforehand. That all changes 180. So, you know, it's a spiritual journey.
Ari, could I jump in there for a minute?
Please,
this is Birju.
Please, Birju.
Okay, I'm just first of all, I want to share that I'm just really moved by what you guys are sharing, and thank you so much for doing that. I also wanted to take a step back on the logistics and just name that we're having a little bit of technical issue with the email address that I offered earlier, the Ask at Service Space email address. So if you did send any questions or comments through that portal, if you could send to a different email address, or going forward to a different email address, which is my own, at birju@servicespace.org. So that's B as in boy, I as in Iris, R as in Roger, J as in Johnson, U as in umbrella, @servicespace.org. Or again, *6 works. But unfortunately, if you sent something to ask@servicespace.org, it will not have gone through. So I just wanted to make sure everyone knew. I also wanted to ask a question to you, Mark, related to kind of the more nuts and bolts of this, because I do feel that talking about these pictures really doesn't do them justice. They are huge and they are rich. And can you just share a little bit more about like the size of these paintings, the canvas that you're working with, the kind of palette that you work with, that kind of detail?
Yeah, I did 11 8-foot by 8-foot paintings, and those all deal with different excuses that the shelters use to kill the dogs, and they also deal with dog fighting, they deal with animal testing and all that. So the large ones have usually dogs that were fairly well known, and we use them for the large paintings to tell the story about a lot of different things in the animal welfare world. The other ones that I did were 12 inch by 12 inch, and they were oil on panel. And if you actually hung them 10 feet high, so if you stacked them 10 feet high, they would go 2 football fields long. So the way that I've always approached my work, and you know, when I used to teach, there's a couple ways that I approach it. One, I think that, you know, I used to start paintings where I would just start with the paint, you know, the different colors and all that when I started painting a raw canvas. And that becomes, for a lot of artists, it's pretty scary just to look at a blank canvas going, where do I start? And so what I started doing is I would cover the whole thing in sepia, you know, the sepia color. I would draw with a marker, you know, a Sharpie, a permanent marker underneath. And so when I would cover the whole canvas with this kind of this deep sepia color, then I could actually start wiping out the light. So I could work from light to dark very quickly, because I would have one brush loaded with black, and the sepia would work as my mid-tone, and then the rag where I was wiping out would work as my whites. And so it was a very quick way to work, and it was also a way where color would not distract you when you're looking at composition to put these paintings together. Because really, if the composition doesn't work, the painting's never going to work, no matter how well it's painted. So I always started from that place, you know, where it was the sepia, where I could work through it very quickly, and it was spontaneous. And if it's more spontaneous, you know, just like when I was doing gesture drawings in school, they were like for a minute or 30 seconds or 15 seconds. So it was very guttural responses, and that's what I wanted from the sepia phase of it. And then as I started, you know, kind of working in the color, I would put these clear, transparent glazes over it, you know, and there's certain colors in painting that are transparent and certain ones that are opaque. And like viridians, ultramarine blues, alizarin crimsons, those are all very transparent colors. So I would work the transparents over the sepia, and then I could start working paint sticks into it and palette knife and everything else on a wet surface. And that would be my first kind of push to start getting color into it. And then after that, I would start working into a more polished form of what I wanted the work to say.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm just trying to pay attention. You're 5,500 of these. Is there, I think if you think of writer's block, you know, people are writing a novel, and I have to imagine it's not so different for artists, you know, block as well. Like, did you, were there times where you could sit down and nothing would come out, and other times where you just would just flow, or was it relatively consistent?
It was fairly consistent. I think that the Marina's point where the shift kind of came halfway through, which how I was looking at them, you know, I knew that there was a shift that was needed on how I was, the perspective I was looking at the animals from. And so it became much more up close, because depending on how you're placing this animal in the picture, I mean, how do you want this viewer to react to it? And so as time went on, as I became more engaged with each of their souls that I was trying to paint, I wanted the viewer to do that also. And so the views of the animals became much more up close and much more into the viewer's face. But there was no lack of subject matter, and I think that my paintings that I used to do previous to this project, which really had nothing to do with animals, was a lot different. I mean, it was just a completely different approach, where the subject matter was coming from within me, but this subject matter was already ready-made. It depended on how I wanted to actually interpret it and what I wanted people to feel when they looked at it.
Mm. Well, one of the things that comes to mind for me is as I looked at some of your art is this it's something I've seen in my own life. I this last summer I went and I visited factory farms, confined animal feedlot operations, and slaughterhouses, and I saw in myself, and I see this in society, is that as we see a large number of beings exposed to cruelty or slaughter or confinement, that there's a, like, the heartfelt response isn't as strong, except when you look at a single one that's being slaughtered or confined, and you look at, like you said, you look at its eyes, it's a total different experience, as opposed to, you know, there's this idea that they've shown psychologically that's really prominent, that that can be expressed as the idea that when one animal dies, it's a tragedy, or one being is in pain, it's a tragedy. When a thousand die or are in pain, it's a statistic. Is that something you saw right away, that you talked about the eyes, that people needed to look in the eyes? Because I see that really strongly as something that there's this cathartic response to, as opposed to, like, talking about the problem as this, like, enormous issue, which for some reason causes people to zone out?
Well, I tell you one thing that both Marina, and Marina can speak to this too, that we realized is that there was a rescue group when we were in Louisville, and that's where we did the majority of the project. And they came to visit us for a specific reason, and we had to go back to our house. And so they were left in the studio by themselves. Being left in the studio by yourself to confront these images was a completely different experience, because what a lot of people tend to do when they come into the studio, when they don't really want to look at the eyes, and exactly what you were talking about, when they don't want to look at the imagery, they start engaging with Marina and I in conversation very quickly. And so it starts to turn towards them. It doesn't turn towards the imagery and the project and the animals, because it's something that they just don't want to face, and we could see that. And
they start crying.
Or they start crying. I mean, all of them do. And so I know that when we worked with the school kids and we were showing them how to use art for social change, it was a group of ninth graders. And so we didn't want to say anything to them. We just wanted them to come into the studio and react. I mean, because when you start talking about it, then all of a sudden it's a way for them to build this kind of little wall with their emotions where they don't have to really react. They don't have to really feel, because they're talking, you know, and it doesn't become real. But when they're left by themselves to walk around and look at the imagery, it's a completely different deal.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that happened there that was very powerful was that these kids, you know, they enjoyed the process. It was very hard for them. But at the beginning, even coming into the studio, obviously it affected them. And we were working with them to do woodcuts to create this powerful imagery to raise awareness and funds. And it really, Mark and I, you know, especially Mark was looking at the imagery that they were drawing, and he said that, you know, to the principal, he said, that there's no soul in this, they're not getting it. And so we quickly, what we decided to do, we didn't tell them what the content was, we just said the content was difficult. So we showed them a video, and so we said, everybody has to watch this. It wasn't an option. It was, if we're going to participate and take you through this process, you are required to participate in the watching of these videos. So we showed them a short clip of the trailer from PBS about the project. Then we segued into showing them what we had seen, one of the videos where these dogs were being taken and thrown into a gas chamber. Then the gas pipe was hooked up. You'd hear these dogs squealing, you know, happy at first and then squealing, and then the silence. And then you'd watch these guys with the hook go and grab puppies and throw the puppies on top of the now dead bodies. And then you'd hear the puppies kind of jumping up and down, and then you'd hear the squealing and the terror, and you'd hear the silence. And we remember the silence in the classroom as these kids were watching, and they stayed very present to what was going on. And what was significant about it was that after they had watched it, they said that they did not get it until they watched the video, every single one of them. They said as hard as that was for them to watch, and that they wanted to get up and walk out, it was the very thing that brought it home to them. And then the work completely changed. I mean, their work became so powerful in what they were drawing. It was pretty amazing. And then when we fast forward to the end of the process and we took them individually and interviewed them one by one, it was profound what they had to say about their own inner transformation and then how they now wanted to take it out into their world and into their own future as leaders.
Wow. I'm just picturing what it is, like the transformation these kids went through. They could have just been going through the motions and trying to make something look good, as mm-hmm. opposed to really feeling into their hearts and how, like, your hand gets infused by your, like, this heart energy and how it would transform what someone created.
Yeah, it did.
You mentioned one of the things Marina mentioned, Mark, was that in the process of doing this, you changed, you broadened your heart to include multiple animals outside of dogs. Is there anything anything you could talk about that, or the insights that came around about food choices, and how that came about from understanding, the dogs and their souls?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, I was changing my diet before I met Marina, and then it just went completely vegan. And at first it was for health reasons, and the more I got into the project, it started spreading out into really compassion for all animals. I mean, there was a video that I watched one time, and it was these cows that were going to be sent off to slaughter, and Marina can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was in Germany. And so anyway, somebody came in and they bought all the cows, and they just let them live out their lives. So as soon as they bought the cows and they let them go for the first time into the field, you could actually see the cows, just hopping around and jumping up and down, and it was amazing. So you know that they knew. You know that there was a soul there. You know that they felt stuff much deeper than we ever give them credit for. And so, there's so many instances where I've seen cats and dogs with other animals and all this. So, I mean, there's this kind of harmony, this built-in harmony in nature and on this earth if we let it be. And so I have no desire to disrupt that at all anymore, especially with, the way that I choose to live my life. And, at first it was health reasons, like Marina, and then it became much deeper and much more profound than that to this day. So, the project has opened my eyes to so many things. I mean, there's so many things that I've learned through this process. Some of them were very uplifting and some of them weren't, but they were all certainly learning and teaching experiences for me.
An area where I've felt a lot of grief over the years is this propensity I see that people who really care for cats and dogs sort of end their circle of compassion there, and they're willing to love these animals and eat these other ones. What is it you think about, like, that helps people draw, expand further out, that if they, that to see that, like, a cow is a pig, is a chicken, is a turkey, that, like, these all is a cat, like, they share that one maybe like a companion animal, one's not, but, like, they have the same similar capacity. Like, do you have any insights that we've seen people start care for dogs and cats might incline them to start caring for animals most people only know as breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
I would say that it has a lot to do with, I think I mentioned it earlier, that we're conditioned to relate to a dog or a cat as a pet, as an animal that we have in our homes because we've had them in there for so long. And there isn't that same relationship to the cows and the pigs because we've been conditioned, just like I was growing up, that those are animals that you eat. Those are required for protein. They're required for all of these different reasons. And so there's two different narratives. So when you're trying to make that connection, there's a different, you have to introduce, you're going to have to argue different points. It can't be the same point. You know, it's like when people say to me about the Chinese eating cats and dogs, and as horrific as that is, it speaks to a culture that doesn't have the separation, that they consider all of those animals in their belief system are on the plate. And it's just our culture has separated them. And there's all of the profit-driven industries around that, from, you know, you need X amount of animal protein, you need, you know, and as I started out as a nutritionist, so I was very objective about why I switched to a vegan diet. It was not for compassion. It was not for an emotional reason. I actually just couldn't see any evidence to support the human body that was designed for animal food. There was absolutely nothing, and I did a lot of research, so it didn't make sense to me. So I can educate someone on that level, but just you still have to deal with lots of other conditioned ideas about it. And so, you know, for us with our project, we know that people are already connected to the companion animal. I mean, you know, the idea is to get the exhibit up, to create an interactive space where people can come and participate, you know, schools, people from around the world, and you have an audience in there that you can actually, they're coming there because there's already a connection for them to the companion animal, and that's the point where you can introduce them to all these other areas, these other ways of expanding your consciousness and your compassion. But if there were 5,500 pigs up on the wall, nobody's coming, except for a tiny percentage of the population. So, you know, there's no point in appealing to those that have already changed.
So in many ways, this is what I'm hearing. It's what you said, and what I've heard more in the conversation is this is really very much a segue to not just opening hearts to dogs and the problems. Maybe what started off is really bringing attention to this problem of overpopulation of dogs and people breeding versus adopting, but really just about in general about how humans, our consciousness and our compassion, expanding it outwards, unbounded, to include not just one species, but the, you know, tens of thousands and millions of species that exist on this planet.
Yes, and that extension goes to humans because, you know, there'd be no need for charities if humans were actually humane. You know, the majority of these issues are created by people, and so in some ways the charities are Band-Aids, and we're never getting down to the real problem, you know, which goes down to the ideology, choices, behaviors, cultural context, you know, things like that. But it comes down to the individual. So, you know, there are so many multi-prongs here because you've also got to look at the relationship between violence in interpersonal relationships. Often you can find those individuals who were violent with animals as a child. And so there's all of these extensions where you've got people, abusing animals. And when you can see these relationships early on, where you can help that individual with that problem so that it's not extended to the animals and then it's not extended into the relationships themselves, you know, because we pass our pain. You know, a lot of us come from troubled environments, and if we don't learn how to navigate that pain, we pass it down to the weakest link, which is usually children or animals. And as a society, we focus on, you know, the well-being of a child. We ask the child how it's doing with reference to its grades, you know, getting a high IQ and high I grade, rather than helping them cultivate compassion and focusing on high emotional IQ. And so that's really what we're doing by going into those schools, working with the kids. We're going much, much deeper into cultivating those roots of empathy and understanding it in a holistic, the gestalt, how it affects us in our collective happiness as a society.
Yeah, well, one of the things I really take, I hear it being emphasized by Marina is this idea of not looking away, as you said. You know, this, mm-hmm. and it's just this broader notion of seeing this sense of apathy. There's a guy named James Truslow Adams said, the freedom now desired by many is not freedom to do and to dare, but freedom from care and worry. So like there's this idea that freedom exists. Our freedom is the freedom to be ambivalent, almost, not have to engage with discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like what your project here is, Mark, is so much about is people having to face what is this uncomfortable? What is difficult to see? What causes grief? You know, and so like what are you seeing? You talked about these children. How have you seen them change more broadly than having painting differently? And other people have seen it. You mentioned other people who came in as well. Like, what are you seeing some of the after effects of touching in to this aspect of bearing witness and not looking away or looking towards it? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think that, we're born to create, you know, and it's something that's inherently, I think, within everybody. And, the schools, it's one of the first programs that they cut out is art. And so I really wanted to approach art in a much different and more profound way with these kids. And I wanted to make it meaningful. And if it's meaningful for them, they'll want to do it. And so there was a group in Virginia that we worked with. And it was a middle school, sixth graders. And so they were using our project as a model. I mean, and so they were going to do artwork. They were going to have an art show. They were going to help rescue groups, the shelters in their area, all that. Well, it did much more for them because the kids started going home and one of the kids, and even the teacher didn't know this. Because we did a Skype with them. And so at the end of their semester, we would do a Skype with them. At the beginning, we'd do a Skype with them. And so at the end of the semester, they would come up and it would be after school and there'd be like, well, there's only supposed to be like 30 of them there, but there was like 100 of them there. And so they were all coming up to ask questions and they were extremely engaged. And so one of the girls was talking about that she went home and told her mom, they go, how many products do we have that are using animal testing? And so they started going through all the products in their house, and they said, we can't use this anymore. So they started throwing them all out, and then she actually started going to the store with her mother to pick out products that did not use animal testing. So it went so much further beyond the artwork itself, but the artwork was really the segue to get them into this, to start them thinking in a very conscientious way, not only about their artwork, but the impact, and not only the impact that their artwork would have, but how they live their lives and what kind of impact that would have. And so I just see the art piece of it, and there's so many schools that are just doing exercises for the sake of doing exercises to learn how to use a new medium, and you can do something that's actually purposeful along with learning how to paint. It doesn't have to be, I have to do a color wheel. It's meaningless. You can still learn about colors without having to do a color wheel, or color charts or value charts and all that stuff. So how do we want to approach this? How do we want to do it? And so the kids love animals. They all talk about the animals that they had in their lives, how much they meant to them. How they and the kids boycotted the circus because they knew that the animals in the circus were mistreated, so they all boycotted the circus. And, so there was all these things that became just much more aware. And at a sixth grade level, I was never as aware of these kids. I think at 12th grade, I don't think I was as aware as these sixth grade kids. And it was just really a profound experience for Marina and I to talk with them and engage with them. And to see how what they were doing had really profoundly changed them. And I know that, Marina remembers other things that I don't remember about the conversations, but those were just a few of the things that really stuck with me.
I would just add the thing that struck me by what a lot of these kids were saying was in the essence of what one of them said was that you know, before doing this process and seeing what an active dog was doing and working with us, that they saw that they could paint, you know, that they could create their art, you know, to go with the wallpaper, the walls or the sofa, or, you know, just paint for the sake of painting. And now they felt that they could paint to change the world. And to me, that said it all. And they were obviously aside from the awareness and money that they raised through their campaign and having an extraordinary teacher, Aaron Welty, that really cared. So it was amazing. Mm. They are the leaders of tomorrow, for sure. And we want to be part of influencing that with those seeds of compassion and showing them how they can use their creativity to be a voice for all social issues.
Hmm. Ari, did we lose you?
I'm sorry, I hit mute by mistake. There's a quote that says, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood, and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. And, like, I'm hearing that wisdom, you know, totally being expounded by your teaching about, like, what is, like, not to do color wheels and things, but think about how does your art change the world and make it be a better expression of your heart. So with that, I'm so grateful for the time, and I'm going to participate a little more as well, but I'm going to let Birju take the lead for the rest of the conversation.
Thank you, Ari, and thank you, Mark and Marina. It's really been a privilege just to listen in. And what you just shared about how, to me, anything could be imbued with the values of compassion, whether it's painting or anything else, that to me is a heck of a lesson. I would like to invite anyone who does have any reflections or insights to share. *6 is probably the best way to go. Would love to hear from you. In the meanwhile, I'd love to ask a few questions myself, if I may, Mark and Marina.
Sure.
I'd love to kind of take a step back and would love to listen a little bit about where you both are coming from. Like, have you lived saintly lives to prep yourself for this kind of movement? Or, where are you coming from? This is amazing.
Oh my God!
No, there's no saintly lives.
I think I would actually implode if I walked into a church. So, but no, I mean, you know, my life I took a big turn almost 18 years ago, and you know, I was pretty much drinking my life away, and there wasn't a lot of purpose to it, and you know, the day I got sober was the day things really changed for me, and it was probably the most important day of my life. It gave meaning to my life, and it actually made my life where I could actually have one rather than just existing and taking up space in this world. So I'm very grateful for that, and I think that's where the shift really came for me. And you know, and before that, you know, I mean, you know, I guess I did some things that were good, and I'm sure some things that were bad, but it certainly didn't have a rudder to it, you know. And sure. Now I've had to grab onto a spiritual anchor, something that works for me, and it's continued to keep me sober to this day, and I'm grateful for that. And that was really a very important day for me. I've known Marina for 8 years now, so I don't know how saintly or unsaintly she was previously to me, but
To answer, let's see. I would say I come from a background of a lot of violence, alcohol, and a big, large Irish family. And so what I was interested in doing from a very early age was seeing how, as human beings, there was a place where we could be heard, that we could hear each other without the violence. We could hear each other without the make wrong. And so that led me on my own path. I started out as a nutritionist, and then I saw that I could get people well, but emotionally they were still stuck. And so I was always my own lab rat, and then looked at where I needed my own transformation. So then I ended up coaching executives and couples and stuff for over 25 years. And my interest was really teaching people how to drop the pretense, how to tell the truth, and ultimately how to hear each other, how to navigate that conflict. And so I was creating compassion, you know, finding compassionate solutions to people problems. And so this to me was just another extension, because I was already vegan for so long. Turning my everything I had learned and cultivated to animals was just, it was just easy, you know, just made sense. You can't turn away. I mean,
I appreciate hearing a bit about your own background and how that led you into the work that you're doing in the world. And I'm curious, similarly for you, Mark, that I'm sure that you're familiar with many beautiful causes. You're the CEO of what I believe is an art-based consultancy. And so I'm curious, one, how did that work come about? And two, you know, among the many causes that you must have come across, what was it that stuck about this one with you?
When I got into the one where I was helping transform blighted areas, and, you know, our goal was not to, big word is gentrify. I mean, that was never a thought in my head. My thing was to actually give artists a way to actually own something and have property. And I think that, you know, if you look at the past, you know, anywhere that they infused the arts into these communities, they took off, whether it was Greenwich Village, Soho in New York or London or wherever it was, you know, the arts always took off. But the problem was is that the artists never really owned anything. And so they would be the first ones to get booted to the curb, because all of a sudden the place started becoming a hip place to live. And so it was when I was first getting sober that that I lived in this neighborhood that was just full of drugs and they were making a lot of meth down there, because you could smell it coming through the sewers and all that stuff. So anyway, I owned this house down there that I had renovated, and I just knew that, you know, I could never get rid of this thing, you know. And so I went to the city at the time and met with the mayor, and he had all his people around him. And I said, you know, this is absolutely brutal down here. I said, none of you sitting around this table would even live down here. And I said, I need your help to fix it up. And I said, if you don't give me your help, I said, I'm just going to sell it to one of the other slumlords and I'm getting out of here. And so he said, well, he goes, he knew that the stuff that I was proposing that they actually take on as a city, which was this rental licensing ordinance. That's how I got started in it. And what the rental licensing ordinance did is if you had rental property, which we had like 80% rental property down there, 85% rental property, and a healthy neighborhood has about 25%. So we were like three times that. And I said, so if we're going to have this much rental property, you know, you have to actually have something governing over this stuff, because these guys are running these properties into the ground. They're getting as much rent as they can out of them. And then when they become too dilapidated to actually rent, the city tears them down at the taxpayers' expense, and then we lose another historic property. And I said, I'm really sick of it. So I said, the rental licensing ordinance, what they did is it worked like a driver's license. So if you want to drive a car, you got to go take a test, and then you get a driver's license. Well, if you want to rent a property, you have to have it inspected, so it has to be up to a certain standard code-wise, and then you can get a rental license and you can rent it out. So it really made them fix up their property so we didn't keep losing pieces of our city. And he said he would do it, and they passed the ordinances through after a lot of consternation. So then I told him, I said, well, you know, the ordinances are great, and having more police around here is great. I said, but it's not going to solve your problem. I said, you're going to have to infuse something into this neighborhood to actually turn it around. And I said, I've got an idea. I said, why don't we offer an incentive package for artists to come down here to buy a piece of property to fix it up? And I said, when nobody down here, I said, the place was so blighted and so stigmatized, none of the townspeople were ever coming down there. And so I talked to one of the commissioners, and I met with the mayor again, and he said, yeah, we can take this on. And they said, well, do you want to work for the city? And the first time I told them, no, I didn't really want to work for government. And the second time they came back and I figured out I needed to be doing this. And so, I started working for the city and started working in the planning department and started piecing together a program that became a national model, and a bunch of other cities around the country started emulating what we were doing. So, and it was really, you know, everybody thought I had this, you know, grand scheme and grand plan. It was really just about fixing up the neighborhood I lived in. And so that's as far as it went for me. And really, it got myself out of my own head, which was going to help me, you know, stay sober. So it was really self-preservation more than anything, but it turned out to be something much bigger than that. This project now is just something that was very close to my heart, because I know when I got sober, all I really got out of the divorce, which I went through at the same time, was my two dogs, which were, you know, meant everything to me. So I didn't really care if I was living on the streets or in a palace. It didn't make any difference. I wanted the two animals. And so they became a real big part of my life. And that's why I got into this project.
Wow. Thank you for this context. Super, super helpful. And just building that picture of you coming around this, the specifics of what this offering is. And I'm seeing that we do have a question in our queue, so I'm going to create space for that.
Thank you, Birju. Mark Marina, this is Pavi from California, and I just wanted to say thank you so much. It's a small word to thank you, but for all that you've done. But there is just a, you know, listening to your story and sort of the spirit behind it, there is an immense amount of gratitude that comes up, and I'm so glad that we had this opportunity to hear, you know, kind of behind the scenes of this project, what's been in your hearts and minds all these years.
Oh,
I had a couple
you.
Of questions, and the first one was around inspiration. Just as you've been through this journey, and you know, with all the difficulties and challenges and some bumps in the road along the way, I was wondering if there are in your lives, for each of you individually, either you know, what are your sources of inspiration? Are there particular people or mentors or guides that you've looked to, either in the human or you know, other forms? What have those sources been? And the other question was just quickly, could you speak a little bit about the PBS documentary and how that came about and what the plan is for that being introduced to the world?
Sure. Well, thank you for your wonderful comments and your support. You know, one of my, you know, my parents have been a huge influence on me. You know, my father, who really came from nothing, his father was right off the boat from Italy, and they didn't have much at all, and he put himself through school. And he had a job working in Chicago, working for HUD, for the government, and then he wanted to open up his own architectural firm. And my grandfather thought he was crazy leaving a good job and everything else, but he took the chance, and he went after it, and he struggled. I mean, he struggled big time, and he ended up cashing in all of his retirement just so he could keep my mother and four kids in food and clothes. And so So he's been certainly inspirational to me, and there's a lot of artists that I've really enjoyed as far as what they've done with their artwork. Leon Golub is one of them. He was certainly somebody who was trying to do something very significant with his work and really trying to incite social change. And there's many other artists that certainly come to mind. And as far as the documentary,
The documentary, we got connected with them a few years ago, Bonnie Silver and Russ, and they obviously connected to the project and thought it was just wonderful what we were doing, and so they decided to come on board and partnered with KET, and so they've been filming us for the last 3 years following the journey, and that will be probably in the next, I know they've done all the editing and they have sent it off to some of the film festivals as well for international exposure. And then probably in the next few months we'll get an air date and it'll premiere in one city and then it will roll out to to all the cities across the U.S. and probably internationally too. So that's to answer your question on PBS. To answer your question about my inspiration, I would say my own environment growing up was definitely influential. But I would say most significantly, it's working and listening to people's unhappiness for the past 25 years. What I concluded was that all of these people, and they tended to be obviously very wealthy individuals that had more money, more boats, more cars, more. And none of these things were making them happy. And what I realized is that, you know, their happiness was because their unhappiness was because their life was focused on themselves. And as soon as I helped them to shift it towards making their life about being a contribution, it changed. And so that taught me a lot, because it wasn't just one or two of them. It was pretty much all of them. So it became a really great lesson for me it just emphasized it more and more, that being in service to the collective happiness rather than the individual is where it's at. And so this was just a natural extension. And animals to me always, I believe animals really show us what it means to love.
Thank you so much for that question, Pavi, and for, of course, the answers, Mark and Marina. I'd love to go to our next question, which is from Mish in New York City. She says, a heart-tugging listen. Might you know how we compare to other countries in making progress in this area? Bless you both.
Okay, so the question really is, how are other countries doing in this arena?
Yes.
Well, I know that Germany is pretty much a no-kill country. They have certainly come a long way, because at least at the level of their animals, they've got it right. So they understand that when you take the option of killing off the table, you become resourceful. And, I kind of parallel it to children. You know, we don't kill children because they've been abandoned or they're not wanted or for whatever reason. We find solutions. So,
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is that, you know, there's a lot of countries that we're pretty much in parallel with the killing. And so there's we've had so many articles written about us in other countries, and we have had so many people contact us for what we were doing, because they feel the same kind of pain that we have felt as we've gone through this project. And the same issues that we're dealing with in this country, they're dealing with in their country. And we hear from them all the time. They constantly ask us, how can we do this? There's a couple of them that stuck out to me. One was the magazine in India, where they wanted to publish an article about us because they wanted a lot of the artists in India to take on similar sorts of issues and use their art for actually pushing certain sorts of social issues and that. So that one stuck out to me. And the other one was from MSN Latin America. And we were hesitant to do the article at first, and we just didn't know if it was going to work. And then all of a sudden, it just took off. And Marina, how many shares did that?
I think that got about 5.3 million shares on Facebook. Because it really connected, you know, they're much more connected to art in South America. They understand it, I think, much better than where we are. And I would say one of the surprising things was Hong Kong. We had an organization in Hong Kong, where they eat all the animals, including the cats and dogs. They wanted to actually have the entire exhibit right there in Hong Kong. So that to me spoke volumes. The young people there, and also Korea as well. We had a Korean young group contact us as well and made us part of their book, because their work is about those that are doing stuff like this in the world for transformation. So it's been an amazing international experienced, you know. So, and I would say India probably has a lot more consciousness and compassion as a culture, certain parts of India. So.
Well, dovetailing off of this, could you share a bit more about your journey of building community around this, whether it's domestically or internationally? How have you found being connected to others in this space of concern? Do you feel like you're part of a movement?
Oh, most definitely. Yes, it's definitely a movement for compassion. And, with social media and because we've been covered by press around the world, it's really helped connect us to these other people that perhaps feel isolated and alone, or they have that same apathy of, oh, nobody really cares, no one's really doing anything. And it's wonderful to see these people get engaged and want to really, make their life about something that matters. And so it's been very inspiring because we see more apathy in our own homeland than we do in other countries. And I think I said it at the beginning, for two people that didn't have the means to take something like this on, when we come up against people that have the means and then they look away and they don't help or they don't want to see the exhibit up, they don't, there's all these different forms of resistance. We just have to have faith and we just keep going. We believe that when the PBS documentary gets out there, it'll reach people that care and want to partner with us to actually bring this to life in a very real physical space.
Mm. Much appreciating that. And I'm curious about, for the both of you, now having gone through so much of a journey in manifesting this, what is the edge of your learning right now?
What is the edge of it?
Yeah, like what is the place at which your own curiosity and passion is strongest?
I would say the strongest would be making that connection with tomorrow's leaders, which are the kids, which is really penetrating their consciousness at an early age through creativity. And allowing them, rather than them being told what to do or how to do it or how to think or how to feel, to really be supportive and being catalysts for something different for their process, such that they can create the kind of world that we're talking about, because they do want to. So I would say that probably for both.
I feel the exact same way. I mean, I see the kids, and when we talked about it before with the students that we work with here, they don't realize how powerful their voice is. They really don't. And it much like the kids in Virginia, that when they went home and they said, we don't want to buy these products anymore. They're doing animal testing to do it. And all of a sudden they changed. That's the kind of impact that these kids have. Now, if I tried to reach out to the adults and tried to change their minds, that's a much harder sell. That is a much tougher deal because they're in many ways much set in their ways and their ideology and everything else. But the kids are wide open. And they look at things without parameters. They're just looking at them. And so, and then their work, the younger they are, the less inhibited it is. And so it's really honest and it's really guttural work that they're doing. And, I can do really edgy stuff, but I mean, I'll get a lot of pushback if I start doing really, really edgy stuff. And they won't. I mean, nobody's going to go verbally beat up some sixth grade kid because of the piece of art that he did, So they have a platform that a lot of adults and seasoned artists don't have. And so we want to tell them and show them that, that their voice does matter and it carries a lot of weight and it's really important. And they engage with it and they really engage with it. And when their art has purpose, they're even more engaged than if you're just saying, oh, here's some new paints we're going to try out.
Hmm. Very, very much appreciate that response and the aliveness of the next generation as a possibility. One more question for you both. How can this ecosystem, the service-based community that is behind putting these calls on, be in support to what you guys feel most passionate about?
Well, I think you're already doing it, and certainly having us share your platform today and, you know, speak to the heart of your audience is very meaningful to us. We appreciate you all for inviting us on to do it and to continue to share and to let it percolate and think about the conversation that we've had today and how can you all contribute to that manifestation of it being something much bigger. Because we all have talents and resources that could take this to the next level.
Yeah, and if they specifically want to engage with our project, anyone wants to. I mean, you know, Maureen and I are certainly wide open and happy to engage with them and have them be part of what we're doing.
Yep.
Mm. Thank you both. And after the call, we'll be sending out to both on the website and as a thank you email more information about the work that you guys are doing, the location of Active Dog Online, and events and gatherings that you may be connected to going forward.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Thank you.
As we move towards closing the call, we'd love to invite in the space of gratitude for Mark, Maureen, Ari, for skillfully moderating this conversation, and Service Space as a whole for holding space through the process. And if we could just take a minute of silence to hold gratitude for that, and specifically to hold gratitude for all of the animals that Mark and Maureen are putting all their efforts into supporting and raising awareness for. A minute of silence. Thank you. Thank you all. And on the count of three, I would love to take us off of mute just to say thank you to Mark and Maureen. On the count of three, one, two.
Thank you, Mark and Maureen.
Mark and Maureen.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.